This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Friday, March 23rd. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. Over the past week, new stories have emerged about how a formerly obscure political consulting firm, Cambridge Analytica, helped to shape the message of the Trump campaign. Christopher Wiley, a co-founder of the company, spoke to The Guardian about the weapon, as he described it, that he and the CEO, Alexander Nix, created to influence elections through social media.
We would know what kinds of messaging you would be susceptible to, including the framing of it, the topics, the content, the tone, whether it's scary or not, that kind of thing. So what you would be susceptible to and where you're going to consume that. And then how many times do we need to touch you with that in order to change how you think about something?
He goes on to explain how the firm planned to wage a culture war in America.
If you want to fundamentally change society, you first have to break it. And it's only when you break it is when you can remold the pieces into your vision of a new society.
Jane Mayer joins me to discuss the new ways that dirty tricks and dark money are being used to manipulate voters and undermine democracy. Welcome, Jane.
Hi, great to be with you.
So I wanted to get you on today because you wrote about Cambridge Analytica a year ago, before most of us had ever heard of it, and about the Mercer family, who are part owners. Steve Bannon was vice president of the firm until he stepped down to lead the Trump campaign in 2016. How did you first get onto the story, and what did you learn over the course of your reporting about it?
Well, I actually bumped into Cambridge Analytica during the campaign. I interviewed a number of the people working for it in the final weeks before the election, and I was just trying to figure out who was working behind the scenes and who was kind of pushing Trump's message. So I interviewed a bunch of them. Several of them, they were only able to speak off the record or on background. I mean, interestingly, a couple of them were English, and they claimed to have very advanced degrees in abstruse sciences. One of them, I think, was an astrophysicist, and they were experts, apparently, in using data and computers. And their claim to fame, really, all the way through, is that they know how to do to use mass psychology and manipulate the masses on a giant scale by using computerized data.
As everyone now knows, during the campaign, Cambridge Analytica acquired information from 50 million Facebook users. So there's been a lot of indignation about Facebook's role in all of this. But as Adrian Chen points out on NewYorker.com this week, Obama's reelection campaign did something sort of similar in 2012. They used a Facebook app to allow supporters to share their friends' list with the campaign. Really, this is what Facebook does. It mines individuals' data. So what is the scandal here exactly?
It's great that you bring up what happened in the 2012 campaign, because to understand what the Trump campaign was doing and where Robert Mercer, this hedge fund gazillionaire, I don't think he's quite a billionaire yet, what they were aiming to do was to match and exceed maybe what the Democrats had been able to do in the 2012 campaign. Mercer and his family, his daughter Rebecca works with him often, had put a ton of money into trying to get Romney elected in 2012, and they were furious when it didn't work. And so they then, after the election, decided that the Republicans needed better data and better computerized political weaponry. So they sought to create it. They put their own money into creating a company that was an offshoot of an existing English one. And the company they created was Cambridge Analytica, which really kind of got off the ground in 2013 and early 2014. They were copying what the Democrats had done. And you're right. Facebook had allowed the Obama campaign to do this. A key difference, the Obama campaign would argue, was that they openly were hoovering up information on behalf of Obama's campaign. The difference in the case of Cambridge Analytica's work for Trump was this information was vacuumed up under the pretense of doing some kind of cute personality study. So people didn't realize that their information was going to end up helping the Trump campaign. Facebook, who I've been on the phone with this week talking to, they are saying that basically what Cambridge Analytica did violated their policies in various technical ways that made it less ethical than what the Obama campaign did. But really, if you stand back, it was much the same.
You know, I'm also interested in what you say about Robert Mercer supporting the Romney campaign, because the Trump campaign has a very different kind of message. And yet, I also understand from your reporting about the Mercers that they were very much behind this kind of populism that Trump came to embody.
Well, the Mercers came into American politics. First, Bob Mercer made this huge fortune by being a computer scientist, a brilliant one, who figured out how to use computers in many ways to create algorithms that gave him an edge on Wall Street. So he made this fortune in relatively recent years. He is an eccentric person who has very far out views and has never really been particularly involved in public life, but wanted to impose his views on the country by utilizing his fortune to get his way. And so the first step he took was to join the Koch brothers organization, where they had other very rich conservative people trying to use their fortunes to push American politics to the far right. And so the Mercers actually started out there and then became frustrated that they weren't getting everything they wanted. Particularly Rebecca Mercer became fed up with the Koch group. And so they started trying to fund their own kind of organization and a number of different philanthropies that pushed their point of view. Anyway, and where are they coming from? They're coming from, you're right, far to the right of where Romney was.
So Christopher Wiley, who's become the big whistleblower in the Cambridge Analytica story, told reporters that he and Bannon were testing phrases like drain the swamp and build the wall as early as 2014, long before Trump hired them. And Mercer at the time was also paying for other kinds of testing, polling and focus groups and so on. Could you talk a little bit about what was going on?
So what you've got really is Mercer's putting money into Cambridge Analytica. That's one form of sort of market testing and mass manipulation. He's also putting money simultaneously into market research and polling that was being done by a former Democratic pollster, Pat Caddell, who was launching this project that was called Candidate Smith, as in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Caddell was sort of testing the waters to see what was the mood in America, what would an ideal Mr. Smith candidate do, and what he was finding, he told in various interviews, was huge amounts of alienation and anger in America. This was in 2014. People felt that the government was corrupt, and they felt that elites were getting away with murder. There was a rising tide of discontent towards this kind of the 1% that seemed to be playing by different rules. The irony, of course, is there's nobody who's more 1% practically than Robert Mercer, who was paying for this research. But what he saw was a way to tap into that anger, both what he was hearing about from Pat Caddell and what he was hearing about from Cambridge Analytica. There was a way that you could kind of manipulate this growing populist anger and put it behind a candidate.
It's really extraordinary. So Trump becomes a sort of vessel into which they pour these ideas and these code phrases and the rest of it.
So Chris Wiley, the whistleblower from Cambridge Analytica, has suggested that Trump only came in late in the game. In fact, Bannon had been talking to Trump as early as 2011 about running for the presidency, as I wrote in this piece on Bob Mercer. I mean, he was on their horizon for a while. And Pat Caddell specifically was testing what people's attitudes were towards Trump quite early on. And what Pat Caddell said was, Donald Trump was not the perfect Mr. Smith, but he was the only Mr. Smith.
Wow.
He was the only one who hit those notes in some way. Even though the public really didn't like Trump that much, he was the only one who seemed to know how to be an outsider, who had the high profile, and who had kind of the money to be able to wage a presidential campaign.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
I want to hear a little bit more about Alexander Kogan, whom you've spoken to several times over the course of the past year. He's the researcher who secured that data from Facebook and then sold it to Cambridge Analytica. What did you learn from him?
So Kogan has a different story to tell than the way he's been portrayed. He feels he's been turned into a scapegoat by both Facebook and Cambridge Analytica. He is an academic. He's a psychologist who was working at Cambridge University. And he said that he actually did tell Facebook that he was going to be using this data for commercial purposes, and that it's false of them to suggest otherwise. And I talked to Facebook, and they kind of fudge on this. It's very hard to know what the real story is here, but he's insistent that he actually did inform them, and he shared with me the terms of and conditions of agreement that his company gave to people when they agreed to give over their personal data from Facebook. And I've read it, and it says that they're signing away the rights to their own data and to that of their friends, and that they're giving it to Alexander Kogan to use in any way he wants. So it looks like some people were told, and you know, that they were giving away this right to their privacy. Facebook says, though, that he violated a policy they have. Their policy is you can't obtain information in one app and then hand it to somebody else. And he sold this information to Cambridge Analytica.
Cambridge Analytica has clients all around the world. And on Monday, a British news show aired footage of its CEO, Alexander Nix, boasting to undercover reporters that he could entrap opponents by sending bribes and sex workers to compromise them. And he talks about the firm's work in the 2013 Kenyan election, saying that they wrote all the speeches and staged the whole thing. Could you sort of use Kenya as a case study of how they do what they do?
Well, you know, we're only beginning to learn what Cambridge Analytica and its parent company did around the world, and it seems like it's not going to be a pretty picture. If you take a look at Kenya in 2013, one of the things that really interests me anyway is that Cambridge Analytica was working for Kenyatta, who was at the time being accused of war crimes by the International Criminal Court. And one of the things that he managed to do with his campaign advisors at that point was to argue that the International Criminal Court was a form of colonial imperialist intervention in Kenya. And he sort of turned Kenyan nationalism against the International Criminal Court. And if, in fact, it turns out that this was the work of Cambridge Analytica, which is boasting that it ran every single aspect of that campaign, what an irony, really, then. You've got a firm run by Alexander Nix, upper-class, Eton educated British citizen who is handing talking points to a Kenyan politician who's pretending that colonialism is international criminal courts rather than the firm that's telling him what to say in London.
So, but Nix has been suspended, and I'm not quite sure what that means for the future of this firm, where this is the essence of everything that they do.
Yeah, and John Cassidy wrote a great piece for us on our website this week. Basically, Cambridge Analytica said, Alexander Nix doesn't speak for our firm. Well, if he doesn't, then why is he running the firm? You know, the things he said were outrageous. And he also notably said, it really doesn't matter when you're using propaganda whether it's true. All that matters is that it's believed by people. So he's really so openly, cynically manipulative. The only thing you have to wonder, though, with Alexander Nix is whether he's telling the truth even about his own awful record, because he's got a habit of exaggerating that we've seen over the last few years.
Last night, Trump fired his second national security advisor, H.R. McMaster, and appointed as his replacement the very hardline former ambassador to the U.N., John Bolton. I understand that Bolton, too, is a favorite of Robert Mercer's.
That is true. It's kind of amazing how much influence the Mercers seem to be accumulating in this administration. They have been backing John Bolton, supporting him, in fact, financially in some ways for years. John Bolton has had a political action committee, and since 2013, the Mercers have been by far the largest donors to Bolton's political action committee. They've put $5 million into it since 2013, which is huge for a small political action committee. They also, of course, were huge donors to the Trump campaign, and they've been pushing Trump to put Bolton into a position of power.
And what has Bolton been doing since he left the ambassadorship?
Well, one thing that John Bolton has been doing is he has been chairman of an organization called the Gatestone Institute, which is also something that is backed financially by the Mercers in a pretty substantial way. It's an institute that very much pushes the idea that radical Islamic thinking is a threat to the Western world.
Jane, does all of this portend any change in the way that our elections are conducted in the future?
Well, I mean, I think that Facebook has now been forced to recognize that it's going to need some kind of regulation so that there'll be sort of tighter scrutiny of how people's personal information is used and shared, particularly with political organizations and forces trying to manipulate public opinion in elections. So I think this, you know, it's a jump ball. We'll see what happens. But it appears that Congress, it wants to crack down, and so do many other people.
And there are investigations, it seems, in England as well.
There are. And I mean, I don't know specifically what will happen with Cambridge Analytica. Alexander Nix was so much the major mover and shaker at that firm. If he's been suspended, I'm not sure what happens with it. But if there's anybody who knows how to repair a tattered image, apparently it's Cambridge Analytica, since they specialize in burnishing tarnished reputations.
Thanks so much, Jane.
Great to be with you.
Jane Mayer is a staff writer and the author of Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review The Political Scene on Apple Podcasts. This podcast is produced by Alex Barron and Hannah Wilentz for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.